I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news, it's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And the educators on this show, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of our show. So please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today, I am passing the microphone over to my colleague, WNIJ reporter Maria Gardner-Lara, for a special bonus episode of Teacher's Lounge. Maria recently had a conversation with Ahmed Ilkatawi. He's a graduate student in the College of Education at Northern Illinois University, and he's also Palestinian, and talked with Maria about how growing up in Gaza influenced his decision to study education and social justice, and what it's like being so far from his family, stuck in a war zone, and so much more. So without any further ado, let's hand it off to my colleague, Maria Gardner-Lara.
Thanks, Peter. On May 15, Palestinians worldwide commemorated the 1948 Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic. According to the UN, newly formed Israeli forces attacked Palestinian villages, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. You may have first heard of Ilkatawi in a story on W9J earlier this month, when he shared his thoughts on the student protests on college campuses. He also spoke about his family living in Gaza and their struggle to survive. In this larger conversation, Ilkatawi says as the media has focused on the current conflict, for him, it's a matter that merits more context. So we start off learning about his chosen area of study, which is curriculum and instruction with a focus on social justice.
What I was really interested in is how we are using education as a tool for social justice. So basically back in my country, I had a different reason, which was about the mental health of my students, because I used to work like as a teacher back in Gaza. I have taught like for 6 years. I've trained students on how to gain the skills needed to actually get jobs on a freelancing platforms, because the unemployment rate in Gaza was almost 70% because of the siege that was imposed in Gaza by Israel for like 17 years.
Tell me about your concern for your students, and what grade were you teaching?
I was teaching mostly like adults, university students. Students sometimes come to the classrooms, and I feel like I needed to fix something through education and make it more therapeutic for them. And instead of just coming to the classrooms, give a lesson, and then go back home, and then continue your daily life. So that was one of the reasons. But when I came here, I feel like education for social justice also functions as a tool for education, as a tool for liberation, as a tool for enlightenment. That if we make our own students, even in the USA here, like think and question things and question reality and critique what they are studying, I think we would give ourselves as students the capacity to actually make a change. Because some people might say, well, we don't want our children to have anxiety. We don't have to give our adult students to also have anxiety. And I was like, what are we studying? Why are we studying these courses? And what are we studying these courses for? I think as teachers, we need to use education as a tool to make our students do something, make a change. And not only teach them, like, for example, about racism or the injustices around the globe, but how to be anti-racist, how to take a change, how to take a stand, how to stand up, like, for equality, for freedom of the oppressed, and how to actually elevate their voices. So that it drew my attention more to social justice.
And why is that important for you, that not just to learn about injustice, but to understand how to change it?
Because I feel like we are not given like a voice. We are not given a platform to express how we feel, to actually say our narrative. Because we feel like under oppression, your narrative is being taken away from you and also is being dehumanized. You as an individual, you are dehumanized. You are not allowed to even protest. You are not allowed to even say, I want to live. You are not allowed to even say that I want to dream. Like when I was in Gaza under a 17-year-old siege, I did not have the chance to actually travel around the globe because of that siege. I did not have the chance to make it to the person I wanted to be. I mean, I kept like fighting inside. I kept like, you know, trying to motivate myself. Like sometimes you go to the gym, sometimes you run on the beach, sometimes you work in different jobs so you can make a living, because one job is not enough in Gaza. So I worked as a writer, as an interpreter, as a translator, as a soft skills coach, and as a teaching assistant at university. And mostly you are gonna like have the capacity and the motivation to actually make a change in your field. Sometimes you might just wanna be an actor, sometimes just wanna be a poet, but this is not enough in Gaza. You have to do more so you can also give back to community at the same time and feel like you are doing something also for yourself.
You mentioned the 17-year siege.
Yeah.
Tell me about that for folks who may not be... For some folks, the war began October 7th. That's where things happened, and that's when the problems began. But you're saying you're making a reference, right, of something that's larger than that, that's happened before just October 7th. So just can you briefly, for folks who may not be aware, what you're referencing when you say 17-year...
Okay, I also just want to say that this did not start on October 7th. It started like 75 years ago when Israel actually occupied historic Palestine. And we have been living under settler colonialism, under ethnic cleansing, and under genocide for so long. So when I talk about the siege, which is 17 years long, I'm talking about 2007 when Israel imposed a siege on Gaza. Since that day... until I would say today, I became 28 years old, and I did not have the chance to fly outside of Gaza. So during that time, the unemployment rate was almost 70%. During that time, I have survived 5 major Israeli aggressions under bombings. I lost 3 cousins of my family, and with each like major aggressions under bombings, it was really tough because you are alive by coincidence. Basically, under bombings, you don't know when it's going to happen and be your turn. So most of the people who were checking on me, like from outside my home, basically from overseas, have been asking me, how are you doing? And I always tell them, I mean, let's wait until the morning and then check on me again. And then I will tell you how I feel or if I'm alive or not. Or I would tell them, until now, so far, I have a roof above my head. It hasn't been flattened yet. Or I haven't been dissipated yet. So sometimes you can tell them that I'm alive so far. Are you okay? Well, I'm okay so far. You cannot even say okay or I am safe, because nothing was even safe in Gaza before October 7th, or during the previous major Israeli aggressions and their bombings that I have witnessed and lived it through. And it was really tough because you will lose your income, you will lose your capacity to function, the mental health will deteriorate, people like will run out of food. And even when we talk about genocide, this 17-year-old siege was a slow act of genocide. Because the Israeli occupation actually calculates your calories for you so you don't die. So you don't like starve to death. And like a chocolate was not allowed to get inside of Gaza. Lentil soap was not allowed to get inside of Gaza. Like crutches, wheelchairs. I mean, stuff that they labeled as multi-faceted, like tools or items that can be used for different reasons. So mostly they were not like allowed to get in. And people like inside were like, we're surviving. They were not even living before October 7th. And this is why people like of Palestine are like resisting the occupation. I myself, I resist like through the intellectual knowledge that I have. If I talk, if I make a dialogue, if I come to the station, this is a tool of resistance for me because I want to make my voice heard.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tell me about your program. Part of your studies, you're looking at Native Americans. So just kind of touch on that, just a little bit of that study.
So when I came here to study, I studied about Columbus, I studied about the Native Americans, the African Americans. So Columbus is being taught to students as if he was a hero, and there is, I think, a day of celebration here for Columbus. But we should know that he was also a genocidal colonizer. He colonized the land, he enslaved the natives, he sold them in the markets. And to him, they were like slaves, and he actually genocided their mothers and their babies as well. And it wasn't as if it was something to celebrate. So I connected with that under Israeli settler colonialism in Palestine and how ethnically they cleansed all of the Palestinians since 1948. If you are talking about the first massacre in 1948, which was Deir Yassin massacre, almost more than 15,000 Palestinians were killed during that event, which was named al-Nakba to Palestinians, meaning catastrophe. And I connected so much with that because I feel like I wanted to rebel against what I'm reading, because I did not approve of what he did to the natives of the land. As a native, I connected with that, and it meant so much to me that I wanted to speak up my mind also for those who are actually were native to the land, who are actually were ethnically cleansed. And it was a genocide, which is what we are seeing right now in Gaza. Genocide is happening against civilian population in Gaza. Almost more than 35,000 Palestinians have been killed. Thousands are missing and buried under the rubble, estimated to be over 42,000, including 15,000 children and 10,000 women. And recently, there was the largest fertility clinic in Gaza, which was bombed by Israeli airstrike, which destroyed 4,000 frozen embryos and 1,000 specimens of sperms and unfertilized eggs. We are talking here about the future generations of kids that are going to come to life, wiped and annihilated before they even come. There was a baby who was delivered from his mother, dead womb, in an Israeli airstrike that took place in Gaza, and he was orphaned before he even came to life. So we're talking about ethnically cleansing of the indigenous people of the land so they can take more land and thin out the population. So how to thin out the population? You need to kill the pregnant mothers and their babies and their children and their fathers and their mothers so they don't reproduce again. And this is how you thin out the population. You take more land and you control the population. So I connected with all of that.
What has that been like for you? You come here in July. Could you even imagine that this, just months after you arrived, that this would happen back home?
No, I didn't imagine that, actually, to be honest. But since I have lived like all of that before, I was coming here like on a healing journey in a way. I thought I was coming on a healing journey, but with things happening every single time on repeat, it seems like you cannot even heal, but you force yourself to actually be motivated so you can keep going and keep your voice loud so you can talk for on behalf of your people when you make it outside. So I came here, I had a pre-academic program, and then I met like some international friends from 33 countries for the first time. I was 28 years old, and it was the first time to actually be on board of a plane. I have never like flew before, and I didn't know what kind of feeling would that sound. But in Gaza, I have been dreaming to make it to my dreams, to be the change I wanted to see in the world, you know, speaking of Mahatma Gandhi. And I wanted to make a change. I wanted to give back to community, but we were not given that chance. We were like deprived to even use our wings to fly, even though we had the capacity to do and invent and contribute to society. But it was really tough to actually know that you are not given the chance to give back to community. And I refused to believe that I wasn't allowed to actually have that, and I wanted to have it. And that's why I kept applying for scholarships, because I deserve to have my dream come true.
Tell me, for folks who may not understand, like, how limited the opportunities are to travel outside of Palestine.
So, I mean, I would like first to mention how universities in the Gaza Strip and schools are being targeted every single aggressions, you know, under Israeli bombings. When I survived 5 major Israeli aggressions under Israeli bombings, they targeted schools where the population sometimes seek shelter, like into, because there is nothing safe in Gaza. There is no bunkers. There is no anything. So the most fragile, safe place for you is just to stay in your home or just go to a school like UNRWA schools. And then they are targeted sometimes with their like inhabitants inside. And universities have been also targeted and been rebuilt again. So when we are talking about education, it's a very important tool for Palestinian, I would say, youth and Palestinians like in general, because it is what is used to rebuild society. Like when you invest in education, you are making a change. You are finding ways how to actually build the human of Gaza and rebuild him again, because he is being, I would say, damaged psychologically, mentally, and physically. So if you learn and find ways to actually invest in your knowledge, you are going to make a change and you're going to rebuild Gaza. Speaking of infrastructure, speaking of the educational facilities, speaking of business, I would say startups, speaking of job opportunities you're going to create for thousands of students who are fighting like through the darkness and under siege. And they are not even allowed to leave Gaza because they are Palestinian. So we have 2 crossing borders, one with Egypt and one with Israel, which is occupied Palestine. And in order for you to leave, you have to get permits from from Israel and then a permit from the Jordanian authority because we are not allowed to have our own airport. So we travel from Gaza through occupied Palestine and then through Jordan to use their own airport so we can travel and make it to the rest of the world. This is one way. The other way is with Egypt. You are not allowed to have your own airport because it was destroyed in 2005 by the Israeli occupation. You're not allowed to have your own seaport, and you're not even allowed to have your own statehood. I mean, Netanyahu himself once said, I am proud to have prevented the creation of a Palestinian statehood. He doesn't want that to happen. He always says the security of Israel relies on the suffering of Palestinians, and which is wrong. I mean, we have many Jewish friends actually speaking in the rights of Palestinians and the right to the self-determination and liberation and freedom and equality, because we are not having that. We are being treated as if we are nothing, as if we are something to be removed. They are using language. Palestinians are snakes. Their babies are snakes. They are like human animals. They are savage, which is the language that has been actually used to describe the natives of the land, even speaking of the native indigenous people of the land in America by the colonizers who colonized the land. And it is meant to actually give an image of uncivility. So they would come to you and say, well, it's okay to kill them. Because they are that. They are not like us, as they say, which is the us and them, othering the other, because to them, it's, no, he's not like me. So it's very limited, actually, for Palestinians to travel outside. And that's why we created hope for thousands of students to actually apply for freelancing platforms so they can have jobs and have hope, because they're not allowed to find jobs. As I said, the unemployment rate is almost 70%, but the education rate is almost 79%. So the literacy rate is very high in Gaza, but the opportunities for work after graduation is very low because of the restrictions of the siege and of the Israeli attaining that control over the territory. It's very limited to work inside. It's very limited for them to practice what they're learning, but some people might just, you know, work in different fields, as I said, so they can make a living. You might find a dentist whose job is just to go to a clinic to come and work as a teacher of English language. I, as a teacher of English language, I might just go and work like as a writer or as a translator with like overseas visitors who come to Gaza to make research on what's going on, which has been going on for a lot of years now. And it did not start on October the 7th.
Have you ever seen something like this at this level, this kind of attack?
Even like the previous Israeli aggressions and the bombings, most of the families would usually flee to live with other families in the Gaza Strip. And this explains the huge number of civilians being targeted because they not only implement genocide, but they are also using AI to actually implement genocide. So they are using an AI-assisted genocidal tools and programs like Lavender, like the Gospel, like Where is Daddy programs, so they can target the males and the civilians and the children of the Gaza Strip who are, as they say, in an age where they can fight. But they are not. Mostly they are all civilians, and they are being killed in a mass rate.
What's it been like for you to be here while this is happening there?
It was really tough. Like at the beginning, in the first semester, I couldn't take it because I came here and I told my family, first thing I would do when I come to the SA is to actually go maybe see a therapist. I want to heal myself, and I don't want my next generation, my future like kids, to actually come to this universe, and then I don't want anything for me to be passed to them. Speaking of trauma, and I wanted to actually heal myself. And I was like, when I heard about it happening back home, a genocide, ethnically cleansing Gazans so they can take the land, I was like, it's not going to happen. So then I canceled the appointment with the therapist. It's not going to happen. I was like, maybe I just have to keep being resilient. And it's just my destiny to keep being strong. So I went to the gym. I kept on running. Sometimes I talked to some friends. But then my back was really hurting me, so I had a severe pain in the back, I think because of that trauma. So I went by an ambulance to a hospital, a nearby hospital, and then I was cured. I took some pills, and then I got better, and then I decided to not submit to my vulnerability, because as a human being, you know, I have the right to even be sad sometimes, to cry, to be depressed, but also to take that in, and then grow from that experience. So in Gaza, you don't have the luxury to actually collapse and process what you are feeling. You will have to just keep taking as much as you can, and then you have to keep going and be strong for your family, because your family is relying on you as a stronger branch of the family. So it was really tough. I mean, especially also knowing how the country that I am in is also complicit in genocide by funding the genocide that is taking place in my home country. I was really frustrated by how the politicians in this country are actually abetting and aiding a genocide because they want to profit from the money of wars. And at the expense of killing thousands of innocent civilians, and it's really frustrating for me. Because I thought if we are being policymakers, if we are being politicians, then we have to apply democracy. And I was like, where is democracy and how democracy works? Does it work by aligning with our colonial interests like in the region? Or does it have to be connected with saving the human lives? So it was really hypocritical in a way how things work. When students like a protest, a genocide happening on campuses recently, like Columbia University, we are sending the police to actually arrest all those who are protesting a genocide. So if we are teaching our students in schools how to be a human, how to stand up for justice, how to stand up against genocide, because it's genocide studies, basically an anti-war studies, then if we are sending these police to arrest all of them, then what are we teaching them here? So it was really frustrating to witness all of that from a close lens here. Democracy has to have, I would say, strong foundations on human rights, on equality, on freedom, and on human values. You cannot just kill somebody else in the name of democracy because you want to maintain control of a certain area in the region or to maintain a colonial interest around. This doesn't work. And this has to change. So it was really frustrating actually witnessing all of that from a close distance. Speaking like of Palestine and what's going on right now, it's also more about the land. Because even Netanyahu, when he was in the Security UN Council meeting, he presented the map of Palestine and he erased Palestine, all of it, and then called it Israel. And then he drew a line from Asia to UAE, to Saudi Arabia, to Jordan, to the north of Gaza, which actually crosses to the what is opposite the coast of Gaza, which is a gas mine. So it's all about building a different road that replaces the Russia-Ukrainian trade line at the same time, which has to do with superpower control in the Middle East at the same time. But also, speaking of occupation and taking more land, it's also about that hidden reason for the genocide that is happening.
Now, you mentioned, just kind of going back on your comments on democracy, the U.S. prides itself as being a democracy and being a model of democracy for the world. What surprised you in terms of how the U.S. involvement and kind of how this vision of what the U.S. is supposed to be versus kind of what you're seeing in terms of how democracy is actually functioning or what role it's playing or not playing in terms of this, in this conflict, in this war?
So it was frustrating seeing all of that and at the same time witnessing how democracy works. I was like, this is not the democracy that I was taught about. I thought democracy is about the human values. I thought democracy is about the human rights. I thought democracy is about standing for the oppressed and solving what's being practiced against him. So I was a Palestinian living in Gaza under 17-year-old siege. That siege wasn't supposed to be there. And at the same time, I'm calling now for a ceasefire for my people to actually live, although they are being genocided like in masses. And at the same time, I want them to have a fruitful life, like not only for a ceasefire to call for, but also for a resolution for the 75 years of pain and aggression and systematic violence against the Palestinian people. Where were the politicians for 75 years and what were they doing exactly, the international actors? Why haven't they come in and then did something to prevent every single thing that is happening from the Israeli occupation against us? And at the same time, we're being silenced and blamed for being dead, even though they are killing us as an Israeli occupation forces. There is like some sort of hypocrisy in all of that. And it is maddening how we're being allowed to actually be killed and nobody's just paying attention to how a human, we can also be like them. And sometimes the humanization also comes through the media too. How many Palestinian, I would say, have been hosted in shows in America, I would say, it was very, very, very minimum, but it wasn't more and equality to the Israeli side, for example, which contributed to the dehumanization of the Palestinian voice, and they were not even given a platform to express their own views and voice.
Gotcha. Tell me, so you haven't taken therapy?
No, I haven't.
You made an appointment and then you decided.
Yeah, I canceled it because I was like, I'm not going to even be healed because to us as Palestinian, I felt, therapy is just a Western concept that people here come in for therapy, But the cause of the reason of that therapy might stop. But for us, it's systematic violence. It doesn't stop. So it's not only PTSD. It's continuous TSD. It doesn't stop. It's like you are married to a husband and your husband keeps hitting you every day. Next day you go to therapy. And then the third day you come back home, but he still also practices his violence against you. So what's the point of therapy if you keep being subjected to violence every single day by him? So it doesn't work. Unless that violence ceases to exist, then you can have a chance to heal. But we are not given that chance to heal. You have no chance. So that's why we are trying to actually force ourselves to keep being resilient, even though we are not resilient. Sometimes you just want to have some rest. You don't have to be looked up as a hero, or you don't have to be looked up as somebody who actually endured so much and is still, like, he's alive. This is sometimes romanticism when it comes to suffering, that some people like might just feel comfortable, or because you just made it out, even though you went through so much. And for me, this makes you feel comfortable because you did not do a lot to actually make this violence stop. So demonstration, you know, talking to council city members, pressuring the governments, protesting in the streets. I think we should do more into that direction so we can, like, change the policy and how things work in terms of all of these things. Suffering is not supposed to be romanticized. It has supposed to actually be looked at from the root causes of the problem. And for that cause of the problem, it has to stop to not bring any suffering more again.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So you have your mom and dad and your siblings right now.
Yeah. And I have them in Gaza.
How often are you in conversation with them?
Times when the internet comes back again, because it is being disconnected, you know, because of the bombardments. I cannot reach out to them sometimes. So I stay like awake until 4 a.m. so I can, you know, just say hi or how are you doing? How's it going for you? And what are you eating? What did you eat today? So I check on all of that and see how the daily life works for them. Because as I said, like, my dad lost weight. He wasn't like before, and he doesn't even eat much because I think he lost the appetite even to do that. He spends most of his time outside the home trying to actually provide food for the family. So it's really tough. I mean,
so your family was able to stay in their home?
I mean, they are staying in their home because, as I said, it's the safest place for them, although it's not safe. It just, as I said, you're alive by coincidence and you are praying to stay alive. But yeah, I mean, even like my dad got sick, even sometimes the food like get ruined. There is no electricity. There is no medicine. Most of the hospitals like got destroyed and bombed. And there is no nutritious, I would say, healthy food for them. So currently they were like relying on some canned food, which sometimes can also be not even healthy. And like, as I said, the electricity before, like during the siege of 17 years old, were coming only for like 4 hours, 6 hours, because it wasn't allowed to come at 24-hour time by the Israeli occupation. The water also too, it is being cut off, like the sewage, like I would say canals are being targeted, the infrastructure is being targeted. Everything is being genocided, like ecocide, femicide, I would say schooleticized too, speaking of schools. And the genocide that is taking place on the physical sense of it, of everything that represents your own cultural heritage at the same time and existence. And this is what is happening. Like, if they do that, they ethnically cleanse the area, they take over control of the land, and then they're gonna like use the mine of the gas off the coast of Gaza and keep the occupation being, you know, expanded every single day.
Just want to go back. You mentioned romanticism of suffering.
Mm.
Just talk to me a little bit about that.
So when I came to the USA, I met a teacher, and we were like having debates inside the classroom, and he told me that I think I should be lucky to just have some stories and that I would receive some attention here in the US. And I was like, who told you that I want to receive the attention in the first place? I didn't choose the suffering and the pain I was going through in the first place to be projected as some sort of sign of attention for people to come talk to me about my own stories of pain. So for me, it wasn't a happy story to share of an attention that I didn't actually ask for. I wanted just to have a normal life like any other human beings living and practicing his own life in the universe. So I did not take that comment well, because I don't romanticize my suffering. I don't romanticize my victimhood. I wanna change happen. And I want the source of that suffering to actually stop once and for all. and permanently. I don't want to live, you know, in suffering anymore. So when people come and look at you, well, you are a hero or you survive. When I went to the hospital around here in the US, the doctor told me, but at least you are here. I told him, yes, but my family is still in Gaza. How can I be fine if my family is still there under genocide? So this is affecting also me. So some people might just say, well, even though you lost a limb or even though you lost a leg, but still you have your own body and still you are just smiling. I was like, who told you that that person is actually happy about losing his limb or losing his hand and still smiling? He's choosing to smile because he has no choice. He wanna survive through his smile. But did he ask for that? No. So if I wasn't in that position, I would say, I want my leg back, I want my hand back, and I don't want to die. I want to live. Because this is my human, I would say, voice would say, I don't want to lose that. I want Israel actually to bring back what I have lost. And it's very impossible to actually be brought back. And this like speaks of the volume of pain. Those people who are like losing their limbs or even being killed, you know, are suffering the aftermath of that, because it's not only a genocide or a war being waged against you, but also even if it stops, there is a silent war happening while you are trying to cope up with your daily life in Gaza, and which is something we have been dealing up with under the siege for 17 years old. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to pursue my education, because I believed that through education I can make a change and I can rebuild my society, which was being destroyed, I would say, in every single aggression against Gaza. The romanticism of suffering, I think, has to stop. And I challenge people sometimes when they give me these like attention or stories of, hey, you are here, I mean, you made it, or they just see you as if you are a hero. And I was like, I'm not a hero, I'm just a normal human being. I mean, I have feelings and I can cry and I can just be in need of a hug from somebody. So don't look at me as if I'm just a hero. I don't want you to be drugged by that feeling of seeing somebody from Palestine who has taken so much suffering and still chooses to actually say, well, I want to live. Of course we want to live. But when you actually submit to that feeling of you romanticizing that pain and romanticizing that suffering, they might like just to stop about actually calling for equality or freedom or for justice, because this gives them like some sort of a comfort that, hey, he's breathing, he's fine. So that's what I'm talking about, that I want people to do more action. Like, I don't want them to just tell me, hey, I'm so sorry, what's going on? And then they come back home and then they don't talk to anybody. No, I want you to just protest in this city. I want to take more action. I want you to talk to your city council members, to talk and protest like against the parliament, like offices and all the politicians, like I would say institutions, and to join a protest, to join an initiative that makes solidarity with Palestine, organize and make organized protesting and solidarity campaigns so this injustice can be lifted once and for all. So this suffering cannot be romanticized and keep being maintained, because through romanticization of suffering, you maintain the oppression against a group of people. You maintain the status quo of the occupation, which is unfair to actually witness and live under, you know.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So just to make clear, you taught English to adults in college?
Yeah, I taught English language for specific purposes. So for example, we have English for freelancing, we have English for AI, we have English for like cybersecurity, and we have English for general like reasons, but mostly for communication skills. As I said, education is a very important tool of the Palestinian society and education, because it gives them opportunity, it makes them like shine, it makes them seen, because we write our own stories. And that's why in Gaza we have created the We Are Not Numbers project, which is a website that tells the stories of all those victims who have been killed by the Israeli occupation for a lot of years now, I would say under siege and even beyond, to humanize the stories and give them more voice, because nobody is listening to our stories. So we decided to create our own website and humanize the stories and say, well, we are not numbers. And each story has a voice and each number has a face, has a story, has a loved family behind that mourns that person, and that he has a life, that this, for example, person plays in music. He loves to actually to maybe ride a bicycle, to go to the beach, ride horses. So when we create that story, which is unfair to actually do so much so you can prove that you are a human and you are deserving of life. But we have to do it.
You said you have to do it?
Yeah, you have to prove to others that you are deserving of humanity or to be seen as a human.
Tell me the name of the project again.
It's We Are Not Numbers.
Is that online? People find that online. Okay. And I understand you were a student of the renowned poet that was.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experience with the poet and how it was like for you to hear the news that he was killed in this.
It was very tough to know that Dr. Rifat Al-A'ir, who was a poet and academic, a professor of comparative literature and Shakespeare in Gaza, he was deliberately assassinated because he was the voice of Gazans through poetry and literature. And he always like advocated for the rights of the oppressed, for the rights of Palestinians, for the voice of Palestinians, and to make it heard through his Instagram and his Twitter also account too. He loved the strawberries. He loved the traveling. He loved to actually talk with youth, to socialize, to attend the happy moments that students sometimes can come up with. And for me, I worked with him as a colleague at university, and I was a friend of his too. He always encouraged me to pursue my education as a master's student. And yeah, I mean, I miss him so much. And when I heard about the news of him being killed and even remaining under the rubble of his house, it was very tough because I just, you know, met him and then left Gaza, and then he is deliberately like assassinated because he was speaking out under oppression. And this was the Israeli oppressive approach that if you speak up on social media, you are being targeted and you will be killed because you are challenging how you want to actually live free, you know, under occupation. They want you to just keep being enslaved and say yes to the occupation, say yes to the siege. But as a human beings, we all long for freedom and we want to have our own equality and justice, you know, and the freedom actually to be normally human beings and not to be treated or discriminated against. So yeah, Dr. Rifat was really an inspiring academic. He taught thousands of his students and he taught his stories and how the power of his stories work and how a voice is actually needed and how people out there are looking for our stories, because as a native of the land, people come and ask us a lot of questions and they want to learn more and they want to be educated on many things. But if they want to hear it from a first-hand perspective, things can change and it can challenge the narrative being imposed by the Israeli occupation. So yeah, he did so much to the Palestinian society. He rebuilt, I would say, the human soul of the Gaza society. That's why he was an educator. He was a teacher and he wanted to do so much to change actually the world. But now he was killed and he wrote a poem entitled, "If I Must Die, You Must Live to Tell My Story." And I think as students of his, we need to continue this voice to be alive and to be loud and to keep sharing it with the world so we can tell the story.
You said that universities have also been targeted. The university that you attended?
Yeah, I attended this university. It was the Islamic University of Gaza. And it was targeted even before many times, but it has been rebuilt every single time. And this time it was also targeted. And mostly all of the universities in Gaza have been destroyed currently, deliberately, because they, as I said, they don't want you to get education anymore. I mean, one of the soldiers in his videos, he was boasting about destroying a university and he was saying, you're not going to be engineers anymore. So it's about trying to actually deprive you from the well of learning and of being educated. And in this year was the first year to pass on Palestinians in Palestine to actually not go to a school or a university.
This year, students didn't go?
No. So basically, they have been staying under a genocide, and this is 200 days of genocide is still happening and taking place.
So you're saying before, in other occasions, people were still able to go to university?
I mean, when they finished, they would just go back to schools, yes.
Right.
Now, like, they're being destroyed, so it will take, I don't know how many times, but maybe decades to be rebuilt again, to be enhanced, because the damage is really huge.
That was Ahmed Ilkatawi, a Palestinian graduate student in the College of Education at Northern Illinois University, speaking with my colleague, WNIJ reporter Maria Gardner-Lara. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. And as always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Please do send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu and keep sending your story ideas so we can bring you the best education coverage possible. And wherever you're hearing this podcast, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it. If you like what we do, it is the best way to help us out and make sure we get even more perspectives on the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear in each and every episode of the show, and a huge thank you to Maria Gardner-Lara, my colleague here at WNIJ, for contributing to this episode. I've been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with a new episode of Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.